Welcome to Foresight Friday Roundup, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Burdick, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Friday, December 3rd. I hope everyone had a relaxing Thanksgiving. Now it's back to the grind for the next 3 weeks. On today's episode of the Roundup, we're going to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, which, other than COVID, may be the hottest healthcare topic out there. Specifically, we're going to discuss a study in JAMA that looked at the percentage of women in top positions at health systems, health insurance companies, and HHS, and a new state health equity scorecard published by the Commonwealth Fund. To tell us what the study and scorecard add to the debate over diversity, equity, and inclusion are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you guys doing this morning? Dave?
After a week off, I'm feeling a little rusty when it comes to preparing for our weekly podcast here. So let's see how I do.
All right. Good luck. Julie, how about you?
I am well. I just finished 2 weeks away for both work and a little trip over Thanksgiving. So I'm so happy to be home.
Got it. That's great. Now, before we talk about the new study and the new scorecard, I wanted to briefly ask you both about your Thanksgiving. Dave, did you try any new or unusual foods this year? And would you try them again?
One of our guests brought something called stuffing balls, which I'd never seen before. They were the size of baseballs and actually rolled around on the plates. I found myself wondering, but not too much, how the stuffing all held together. would I eat those stuffing balls again? Sure. Will we ever try to make them? Probably not.
That's great. Thanks, Dave. Julie, how about you? Were there any new or different plates on your Thanksgiving table this year? And are they one and done, or will they reappear next year?
Well, I don't know if I shared this before, but we went out of the country for Thanksgiving as a makeup trip for our spring break a few years ago. So we had a traditional Belizean dinner, and I had no pie, no stuffing, no green bean casserole, no yams. And I have to say, it was nice, but I really missed it.
Wow. What was on the menu you had? Anything?
You know, a lot of shrimp Creole and a lot of curry coconut fish kind of dishes. Very yummy, very good, but not Thanksgiving.
Wow. Very interesting. My daughter's boyfriend made and brought a smoked beet, B-E-E-T salad that was really pretty good. I do hope we see it again next year. It was quite a hit, and I'm usually not much for beets, so go figure. Okay, let's start out by trying to figure out this new study in JAMA. Researchers from Ohio State looked at the percentage of women in leadership positions at health systems, health insurance companies, and at HHS. At health systems and health insurers, the leadership positions included the CEO spot, all other C-suite titles, and the head of human resources. At HHS, the positions included secretaries, administrators, and division leaders. Women held 58% of the positions at HHS, but at health systems and insurers, it was 15% and 16%, respectively, for their CEO spots. Dave, do the results surprise you? Do they mirror what you see in the field? Even more importantly, how does the lack of gender diversity impact patients?
The results did surprise me a bit, Dave. There are several very prominent women CEOs in healthcare, such as Janice Nevin at ChristianaCare, Gail Boudreau at Anthem, and Karen Lynch at CVS. And given how much of the healthcare workforce is female, I would have thought the percentage of women in healthcare leadership roles would have been higher. It's certainly disappointing that it's not. One statistic that didn't surprise me is that the government does so much better than private industry. In the same way, the military has led on racial equality. HHS is leading on gender equality. The current heads of CMS, the CDC, CMMI, and FDA are women, although Janet Woodcock's replacement at FDA, who was just announced, is male. As bad as the percentages of women in healthcare leadership roles are, they're better than the business world as a whole. Among Fortune 500 companies, only 10.9% of senior executives are women. 37% of these companies have all male leadership teams, and another 21% only have one female leader in a senior role. This disparity occurs even though there are more women than men in the general population, and women earn 57% of the undergraduate degrees, as well as 59% of all master's degrees. This gender disparity also occurs even though there's concrete evidence that companies with diverse leadership teams outperform those without diverse leadership. The Peterson Institute for International Economics conducted a massive global study of 22,000 firms and found that companies with women in at least 30% of the leadership positions outperform companies with no women leaders by 15%. So having more women leaders isn't only the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do. But back to the JAMA study and women leaders in healthcare, the percentage of women leaders, as dismal as it is, looks even worse once you dig into the numbers. And that's because the distribution of women leaders is heavily skewed toward HR and marketing executives, particularly in health insurance companies. Within health systems, 60% and 50% respectively of chief human resource officers and chief marketing officers are women. Within health insurance companies, those percentages are 70% and 60%. So you don't see anywhere near as high representation in the CEO role, the CFO role, chief medical officer role, and so on. I was encouraged, however, that women representation on boards of directors and as board chairs in healthcare companies was a bit higher than the 15% of women leaders within the companies themselves. This is important because having more women in leadership roles leads to there being even more women in leadership roles. It's a circle. Once companies jump into the water with higher percentages of women leaders, they find the swimming is just fine. And one other thing I'll say, you know, being a writer and a lover of words, I really like the term cognition capital that the JAMA researchers used as a way to describe the benefits of diverse leadership. Dave, we'll have to figure out a way to get that phrasing, cognition capital, into our content.
Sounds like a good idea. Thanks, Dave. Julie, what's your take on the findings? Do they mirror what you see in the companies that you work with? And what do we need to do to get more gender diversity in health system and health insurer C-suites?
Well, I think Dave covered the high points pretty well, so I'm going to take us on a little journey.
Okay.
You know, Oliver Wyman wrote a great report in 2019 that talked about the role of trust in promoting someone to a senior executive level. And you know, trust has a couple dimensions, ability and integrity. These are words we mostly understand well in our society, and affinity. And this word affinity, I don't think we understand very well. Its definition is caring for another person and having empathy, personal investment in someone's well-being. So what Oliver Wyman postulated is that trust is key to getting promoted. And most of us don't consciously recognize how it's established and how to ultimately use it in promotion decisions, because most of us focus on ability and integrity, right? It sort of makes sense. And few of us, I mean, men and women alike, honestly, explicitly recognize how affinity impacts trust-based decision-making. So it turns out, and Dave even just kind of brushed over this, turns out that it's much more difficult for women to achieve the same level of implicit trust in male-dominated workplaces. And it makes sense, right? Because it's easier to build empathy with people where you have similar backgrounds. And men share many more life experiences with male executives more so than their women coworkers. And a lot of us have typically fewer opportunities to connect with men in informal or non-work settings. And when we do, a lot of those activities tend to be around things that men like to talk about, football or what like to do, play golf. And most women aren't necessarily interested in those issues or play those games. That's probably a huge generalization. And a lot of us have responsibilities at home more so than our male colleagues, right? And I'll never forget when we had our first confab at Health Evolution and the former CEO of Henry Ford Health System said the first thing she did, and granted she has now retired, so she's easily pushing late 60s. So the first thing she did when she realized the world she was living in is she learned how to play golf. So the question is whether women decide to be more male or not, and this is impacting their ability to get promoted. So when you think about these findings, it just makes sense that the one finding in there that, you know, once you have a woman in leadership role, you see more women. It makes sense that this is a natural kind of breeding ground for how we bring diversity in. And I would argue that this concept of affinity totally applies to diversity at large, and we should really be talking about diversity at large more. And I actually think the fact that we've been talking about diversity at large more, just even in the last year and a half, has probably hurt women and their ability to get promoted, because the focus has been taken off women exclusively and put on this larger bucket of diversity, which is a much more difficult bucket to tap. And we need to be focused on all multidimensional definitions. So that's my soapbox.
That was a very insightful journey. Thanks, Julie. Dave, anything to add to Julie's comments?
Wow. What a rich treasure trove of concepts, Julie. A couple of things. I serve on the board of the Community Builders, which is the nation's largest nonprofit developer of low and moderate income communities. And we have a board that's majority women and majority people of color. And on this question of affinity, I think you're right, Julie. I mean, when I just think about the interactions and the conversations, we're not sitting there talking about, you know, how the Yankees did last night. It's a much richer, more wide-ranging conversation. And that, I think, contributes to the performance of the overall organization, which has been exceptional. The other point I'd like to make also involves a corporate study, this one by McKinsey. I've been pretty tough on McKinsey for the consulting work they've done to increase opioid sales, but let's give credit where credit's due. They've just released their 7th annual Women in Workplace study, which they do in partnership with leanin.org. And to Julie's point about all the increasing conversation about diversity may actually be hurting women, I think that could be broadly true. The McKinsey study is a massive one, encompassing 423 organizations employing 12 million people. They surveyed 65,000 individuals on their workplace experiences and conducted in-depth interviews with women of diverse identities. The overall findings were revealing and very disturbing regarding the impact COVID has had on women in the workplace. Women are disproportionately suffering from burnout. Heroic work done by women leaders to support their teams and advance diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts is not recognized and is not rewarded. Women, particularly of color, aren't feeling as valued and are losing ground in terms of workforce representation and promotions. The study concludes that the state of women in the workplace hangs in the balance, and that absent concerted effort, it could worsen as the COVID pandemic lingers. It's really hard out there right now. And I think Julie's right. We really have to keep our eye on the ball on this and to avoid any more backsliding, particularly since we know when we have diverse teams, we do better in terms of company performance and we do better in terms of societal performance.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. That's great. Now let's talk about the Commonwealth Fund's new state equity scorecard. The Commonwealth Fund used 24 different measures to rank states on how well their health systems function for people of color in three performance areas: health outcomes, healthcare access, and the quality and use of healthcare services. Then they came up with a composite score for each state for each racial and ethnic group in the study. For example, the three worst performing states for Black populations were Oklahoma, Mississippi, and Missouri. The three best performing states for Black populations were Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. Julie, what does the scorecard tell you about the levels of health disparities and health equity across the country? Does the scorecard do anything to move the needles in the right direction?
Well, I guess what's depressing but not surprising is that racial and ethnic inequities are pervasive across all state health systems in this country, both across and within states. So that's it's a lot to swallow. Even in states like Minnesota, which, Dave, to your point, ranked third in the Commonwealth Fund's report, has some of the largest disparities between white and Black, Latin, Hispanic, Asian American, Pacific Islander, and American Indian, Alaska Native communities. So there's the haves and the have-nots there. And then, of course, states like Mississippi, where it's all just relatively, you know, poor performance. What I found with the scorecard is that a lot wasn't surprising to me, you know, with diabetes, Black and American Indian more likely than Asian American and whites to die from complications of diabetes. I think we know similar stats from other report, same thing with breast cancer. Black women are more likely than white women to get diagnosed at later stages and die of breast cancer that could have been treated earlier, detected earlier. So a lot of these stats are known in some way, shape, or form. I think what this scorecard is really doing is starting to get at this issue that a lot of different metric and measurement systems are discovering as they get into health equity issues, which is the law of averages is failing us. And when we roll these numbers up to a place where it hides so much of what's going on under the water, we're not seeing the issues. So I appreciate the scorecard for looking at some of the access issues and, you know, even like flu shot, right? Blacks and African Americans, American Indians are less likely than Asian Americans and whites to receive a flu shot. We know this, but getting underneath at a state level and at a regional level is very helpful.
Yeah, I really pulled back the curtain on this issue. Thanks, Julie. Dave, what does the scorecard tell you about healthcare markets across the country? And are there market-based solutions to reducing health disparities and improving health equity?
The most disturbing thing to me about this study were the comments by the study's lead author, David Radley. He observed that we really don't have health equity anywhere in the country, and that the racial and ethnic healthcare gaps are much wider than previously thought. You know, good for Radley for stating the obvious. We wouldn't have these massive gaps in life expectancy and care outcomes between racial groups if this weren't true. That being said, like Julie observed, rankings are important for their ability to show relative performance and progress. My family in Rhode Island will be happy to be among the top states on health equity. Little Rhodey usually isn't prominent in state rankings. In this case, it might be the equivalent of being a good speller in a bad row. On the other hand, the state's relative performance here didn't surprise me. We moved from Minnesota, which is not diverse, at least wasn't when I was growing up there, to Rhode Island when I was 12. And diversity hit you right between the eyes. Rhode Island is a very dense, very diverse urban population with a strong commitment to social justice and inclusion. So good for Rhode Island. On the other end of the scale, I was surprised to see that Missouri is in the group of worst performing states. Then again, Missouri is where the city of Ferguson became synonymous with racial profiling and profiteering. What can the market do, Dave, about improving health equity? I'm a frickin' broken record on this subject, so I'm just gonna say it one more time to make myself feel good. We need to start incentivizing the outcomes we want to see, not only as it relates to health access, but also as it relates to promoting population health in low-income communities. We're not going to change the way we deliver healthcare and provide healthcare and improve communities and improve community well-being until we change the way we pay for these things. And we know how to do it. It's through capitation, it's through risk-based contracting, it's getting away from this treadmill that we're on of paying for activity without relationship to outcomes. So can we do a better job? Absolutely. Will we do a better job? I'm not sure, because it requires changing incentives, and so much of the healthcare industry is dependent on these perverse incentives for their livelihoods. So it's an ongoing battle.
Well, it can be done, right? Thanks, Dave. Julie, anything to add to Dave's comments?
Well, I would just add that David Blumenthal noted specifically that the scorecard, you know, is really looking at whether people of color are having different experiences than white people within the same healthcare system. And he said almost always the answer is yes. So let's just take a step back and so many issues we're dealing with today and understand what that means to have a different experience with how your doctor's interacting with you, how your nurse is interacting with you, how people are interpreting what's coming out of your mouth as a patient when you talk about what's happening with you. Like, these experiences are very basic, and then they become very systemic in ways that we can see through the scorecard. And we then roll all this up into numbers. So we have to recognize that these experiences have been happening over years, right? Decades, if not centuries. And now we're sitting at places where we really want people to engage with the health system immediately and urgently for the good of, you know, all mankind. And we struggle with the response that we're getting. So we need more kind of scorecard action now to really look at it from the patient, to the caregiver and the leadership of the system. Just like we were talking about diversity, it would help a lot here.
Yep, quantifying the patient experience. Thanks, Julie. They do say what gets measured gets improved. So I think both the study and the scorecard are important first steps in fixing one of healthcare's most glaring problems. Thanks, Dave, and thanks, Julie. Great discussion. Now let's talk briefly about other big healthcare news this past week. Julie, there were a lot of other big healthcare stories this week. What topped your list?
Well, certainly the Biden administration moving to make free at-home tests available to Americans and having that paid by insurance companies. I mean, we are now, you know, better late than never, moving into a test-forward environment to try to get ahead of Omicron. So, and all the other variants to come behind it. So I was pleased to see it, and I hope it works.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. Dave, there's a lot to choose from this past week. What made your number one?
I'm encouraged by these new antiviral pills that Merck and Pfizer are pushing through the FDA approval process to treat early stage COVID cases. They kind of go hand in hand with what Julie was saying about test forward environments. These antiviral treatments disrupt the coronavirus's ability to replicate itself, which in turn lowers hospitalizations by 90% and entirely prevents death. And it's not reliant on finding the spike protein, which is how the mRNA vaccines have worked. The fact that it's in pill form makes it easier to take, so you can take it at home. On the other hand, it's just got to be a lot easier for the government to hide microchips in a pill than it is in a liquid vaccine, right?
Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you, right, Dave?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. For me, it was the two federal courts striking down the Biden administration's healthcare worker COVID vaccine mandate that was supposed to take effect on January 4th. This is why Vito Corleone liked to carry judges and politicians around in his pocket like nickels and dimes. There's your movie reference for the show. Let's hope the two rulings get overturned on appeal. Thanks, Dave, and thank you, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. But before we sign off, I'd like to invite all our listeners to our second annual virtual holiday piano bar. The party starts at 7 p.m. Central on Wednesday, December 15th. You can RSVP on our website at foresighthealth.com. We hope you can join us. It's a lot of fun. And if you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed on today's show, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can find a recording of this podcast and all our podcasts on the Healthcare Now Radio Network, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other streaming services. Subscribe now and don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.